Hi all, thank you for listening to Human Monsters. I also want to thank those of you who donate to the Patreon account. There will be more rewards coming down the pipe, such as giveaways. From now on, every week, a winner will be drawn from the Patreon pool and will receive a psychic reading from me online. I am a card reader and astrologer, and I will do a reading for you online should your name be chosen. Once again, the Patreon link is www.patreon.com/leader1, www.patreon.com/leaderone. Thank you and enjoy the show.
So scared. All I wanted to do was play with you. Please come and play with me. I'm so lonely. You're not afraid of the dark, are you? Don't be afraid. Come with me. I will show you where I play hide and seek. Do you want to play hide and seek? You hide, and I'll find you.
The period in the history of the German city of Dusseldorf between February and November of 1929 was long remembered as a reign of terror. The offender is one of the most notorious criminals in Germany's history preceding the Third Reich. Part 1. The Olliger Child. February 9th, 1929. Around 9 a.m., workmen discovered the body of an 8-year-old girl near their place of employment. She was lying beneath a hedge. Her body faced a wide open space, so it was only by serendipity that her corpse was found. She was wearing a full set of clothes and a cloak. The clothes had been neatly adorned. The clothing was burnt. Her underclothes were still smoldering. These are some findings reported by the coroner. An odor resembling that of petroleum emanated from the body. There were blood stains on the clothes, particularly on the upper body. The girl had been wounded numerous times in her chest. The wounds were inflicted with a passage through the clothing. On the inner part of her underpants, near the vagina, were two small blood stains. The microscopic presence of semen was found, though it was such a small specimen that full ejaculation was ruled out. There was fluid blood which spouted from a 1-centimeter-long wound at the entrance of her vaginal cavity. Her hymen had been torn. The thighs were blackened and discolored due to burning. The hair on her head was black and charred with bald patches. There were 13 wounds on her left breast. Her face was bloated and livid. The stab wounds on her left breast were clustered in an area smaller than a hand. 5 of the wounds penetrated her heart. 3 of the stab wounds pierced the left and right pleurae, which are sacs that surround the lungs that enable lubrication between the membranes. 3 stab wounds penetrated her liver. There were 750 cubic centimeters of blood in her pleural cavities. Death was assumed to be swift due to internal hemorrhage. No soot had been inhaled. It was speculated that the offender wished only to burn the clothing, not the girl's flesh. In the tissues of the lumbar or abdominal region, there was 4 centimeters of blood infiltration. Congestion of blood in the head suggested strangulation, but she was more likely to have died from the stab wounds to the heart. There were no visible signs of strangulation on the neck. More speculation has it that the offender inserted a finger smeared with semen into the entrance to the victim's vagina. He most likely did it in a forcible manner, for a scratch was found at the entrance to the vagina. There was a trace of bruising on the pelvis. The stab wounds on the breast ran in parallel, as if having been rendered with mechanical precision. The knife was held with the cutting edge of the blade pointing upwards. The stabbing was carried out as the girl lay unconscious on the ground. The blows were administered in quick succession. The details of this murder were used as the template for investigating related incidents throughout 1929. A pattern soon emerged, and its familiarity terrified the community, even if it did provide police with a paradigm for investigators to draw a map directly to the perpetrator. That would come later. Much, much later. And, in the opinion of the community, much too late. Part 2. Frau Kuhn. February 3, 1929. A woman known as Frau Kuhn walked along a road in the Flingern district. The road was underserved by both vehicular and pedestrian traffic. A man soon approached. He overtook her, said, "Good evening," and grabbed the lapels of her coat. He issued an instruction, "No row, don't scream." With his free hand, he stabbed her. Frau fell backwards and screamed for help. The assailant ran away. Frau Kuhn survived the attack, but at a cost. She incurred 24 flesh wounds in her head, torso, and arms. She said the assailant stabbed her in quick succession. Part 3. Scheer. A similar attack occurred in the Flingern district, only this victim, a 45-year-old male known as Scheer, did not survive the attack. He was stabbed 20 times. 16 of the stab wounds were observed on a small area of his neck. Except for one, all of these stab wounds were executed along a horizontal trajectory. One wound in the neck and three in his back were cut vertically. Three wounds ushered Scheer into death. One in the temple that caused severe hemorrhage in the brain cavity, a cut in his neck that bled onto the spinal cord, and a wound in the back that resulted in a pneumothorax, or an abnormal accumulation of air in the pleural space between the lung and the chest wall. There were no defensive wounds, and given the pattern of the wounds, it was concluded that the assailant attacked his victim from behind and stabbed him. The paradigm. Medical and legal experts established the pattern to the offender's attacks based on their respective investigations. These four factors were listed as common denominators. A sudden and unprovoked attack in isolated regions. The attacks typically took place at dusk. The victims were dispatched with the usage of a stabbing instrument. Given that the assaults were surprise attacks, no motive could be discerned with the identity of the offender unknown to police. Another factor that complicated the investigation was that an offender known as Stausberg attacked two women. Though there were some minor similarities between the crimes Stausberg and the other offender committed, it was eventually proven that Stausberg was not culpable for the attacks on the Olga girl, Frau Kuhn, and Scheer. Part 4. The Knife Attacks of August 21st. Frau Mantell was walking home in the suburb of Lierenfeld. As she passed a church, she was accosted by a male stranger. He said to her, "May I accompany you, Fraulein?" She offered no reply. The stranger stabbed her in the back. At about the same time, a stranger approached Anna Goldhausen. With nary a spoken word, he stabbed her between her sixth and seventh ribs and passed straight through to her liver and stomach. She survived, but not without a troubled and prolonged recovery. Within the hour, a man named Heinrich Kornblum was accosted by a strange man. The man stabbed him in the back. He cut Heinrich's back braces. In the township of Flea, two young girls were murdered. One victim was 5-year-old Gertrude Homaker. The other was her 14-year-old adoptive sister, Louisa Lenzen. They went to a market Saturday evening and never returned. A search party took to the streets that evening, but they were not located. Sunday, 6 a.m. The bodies of Gertrude and Louisa were found on the market garden, which was located only 200 meters from their home. Gertrude lay on runner beans. Louisa was spread out on a freshly turned bed of vegetables. They were both lying in the prone position. Their clothing did not appear to have been tampered with. No injury had been visited upon their genitalia. 9:15 p.m. the previous day, some people heard the cries of "Mama, Mama" from the general vicinity of the market garden, but nobody attended to the matter. Gertrude Homaker was stabbed in the chest, with the blade striking and severing her right carotid artery. The artery was completely detached. A wound was struck into her neck, measuring from 7 to 13 centimeters in length. It was cut sidewise, erring on the right side of her neck. It curved toward her ear. The wound in question was made with 2 slashes of the blade. One of them nearly cut her larynx. A compression was applied to her epiglottis. Between the epiglottis and the esophagus to the right were markings indicative of hematoma, or localized bleeding. Their dimensions were nearly identical to those of an almond. Her lungs were swollen with an accumulation of blood. Louisa Lenzen bore 2 knife wounds on the right side of her neck. The cuts were relatively superficial, stopping at the scalp. There were signs of a throttling or strangling. There were bruises on the right side of her neck. They were left with the application of 4 fingertips. 2 scratch marks were found under the left side of her jaw. She was stabbed in the back, with 3 wounds to the right of the spine and 1 on the left. The cuts on the right side penetrated her lung and abdominal cavity. That wound passed all the way to an aorta. In the left pleural cavity were 750 cc's of blood. The victim was stabbed through her clothing. The measurement of the wounds ranged from 18 to 20 to 25 and 30 millimeters. The right lung was also punctured. Sunday evening, a sex crime was discovered. 26-year-old domestic servant, known by her surname, Schult, was approached in the afternoon in the township of Oberkassel by a man unknown to her. He appeared to be about 34 years old. They established a rapport, and she accompanied him as they paid a visit to the outdoor market at Nice. Eventually, they made their way to the meadows near the Rhine River. When they stopped to rest, the man, who identified himself by the name Baumgart, made many aggressive sexual overtures. He conveyed in no uncertain terms that he wanted to have sex with her that very moment. She did not cooperate, so he forced himself on her. He pinned her to the ground and tried to remove her underwear. She fought back as best she could. She backed up her resistance by saying, "I would rather die." The words had only escaped her lips when she felt a painful piercing sensation in her neck. Baumgart said, "Then you shall die." He continued to stab her. The final slash was made in her back. He visited this blow with so much aggression that the blade of the dagger broke. He pulled away and said, "Now you can die." He ran away. Once out of sight, the girl cried out for help. A coterie of young people came to her aid and took her to hospital. The Schult woman presented with 3 wounds on her head and neck. There was a slash on her right earlobe and a large diagonal wound on her neck. She was fortunate in that this wound was superficial. The examination revealed 10 more wounds in addition to these. 4 were cut into her left lower jaw. On her right upper arm, the ulna nerve was severed. 6 more stab wounds were found on the left nape of her neck, her left shoulder behind the axilla line, and on her chest. The deepest wound was inflicted between her first and second lumbar vertebrae. Fluid oozed out from the puncture. Her left leg was paralyzed. The broken dagger blade was stuck in the first lumbar vertebra. This incident was significant to the investigation of these crimes, for the victim survived and remembered the assailant. Enter the hammer. September 30th, 7 a.m. The body of Ida Reuter was found in a meadow beside the Rhine, close to Dusseldorf. Her legs were parted. Her clothes were disheveled, and her vagina was exposed. From indentations left in the ground, it was surmised that she was dragged 70 meters from the banks of the Rhine. The offender took her underpants and some items from her bag. By the time the murder commission arrived, rigor mortis had set in. A circle of bruises was observed on her head. There were several wounds on the crown of her head, surrounded by bruises. A pathologist concluded that these wounds were visited upon the victim with a square-faced hammer. There were 3 abrasions in the epidermis on the right side of her neck. There were similar abrasions on the left side. A fracture was observed running from the left side of the skull to the nasal bone. The brain was left relatively unharmed, aside from blood clots in the pia mater, the delicate innermost layer of the meninges surrounding the brain and spinal cord. The dura, or outermost of the 3 layers of meninges surrounding the brain and spinal cord, was destroyed with a blow, leaving a 1 to 2 centimeter rupture. There was a fracture at the base of the skull. Blood was found in the lungs. The stomach was filled with a blend of blood and partially digested food. October 12th, 6:30 a.m. A girl working as a servant, known by her surname, Dorier, was found critically injured and comatose. The location was the Flingern district of Dusseldorf. Dorier was dragged by the offender behind some bushes. Several blows had been visited upon her head. There were bruises on her left temple, 3 to 5 cubic centimeters long. On the right side of her head was a large wound measuring 4 to 6 centimeters. On the occiput, or back of the head, a bifurcated wound was found that measured at 9 centimeters. At the entrance of her vagina, a large tear measuring at an area of 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter was observed. In the mucous membrane, imprints of fingernails were found. Both of the temporal muscles, i.e., the muscles situated in the temples of the head, were lacerated and the adjoining parts of the skull were splintered. On the left side of the head, the dura was perforated. On the right side, it was torn with a slash measuring between 4 and 6 centimeters. Both temples were battered. The brain was injured superficially with 2 nut-sized wounds on the left temple. It was concluded following the post-mortem examination that these injuries were delivered by blows with a hammer. After the vagina was dissected during the exam, a tear was found on the posterior wall. October 25th, 8 a.m. Frau Meurer, 34 years old, was walking home through the isolated Hellweg area within the Flingern district. A man approached her and said, "Aren't you afraid? Quite a lot of things have happened here already." Whatever the man was selling, Frau Meurer was not interested in buying. She ignored him and continued along her way. She was brought into hospital unconscious an hour later. An attending physician found oval-shaped wounds measuring at 2 centimeters. Lacerated edges exposed the bone of the scalp. She was discharged 2 weeks later, completely cured. Her wounds were determined to have been delivered with a hammer or some other kind of blunt instrument. Her wounds were similar to those of Dorier. In the Hofgarten district of Dusseldorf, Frau Wanders was assaulted. She was a prostitute and had just procured work for the evening. A strange man suddenly approached. After negotiating with him for a moment, he struck her on the head with such force that she was rendered unconscious. When she came to, she went to the police and received treatment in hospital for 4 head wounds. She had a square-shaped depression fracture over her left ear. There were 2 depression fractures on the crown and the right temple, in smaller dimensions. They were all indented with a square hammer. Part 5, A Focus on Murder. November 7th, 7 p.m., the Flingern District. Gertrude Alberman was seen. She went missing and was not found for 2 days, when her body was found in the morning. It was left in an isolated area, slumped up against the wall of a house owned by the Haniel family. The corpse was deposited among nettles that would have stung the flesh had she been left alive. She lay in the prone position. Her legs were spread. The clothing was relatively undisturbed, though when her coat was removed, her clothes were found to have been pulled up over the posterior. Her underpants were torn. Her posterior and perineum were exposed. There were 2 stab wounds on the left side of the head. 34 slashes were made on her chest. The cranial fissures measured at 7 to 10 millimeters and ended in the dura. She was stabbed in the heart 9 times. 3 holes were found in the heart, 5 in her liver, 4 in her stomach, and 3 in her spleen, and several more in her lungs. 2 more were found in the aorta, with 1 penetrating. Those wounds were measured at 3 to 4 millimeters. 3 wounds were observed in the left kidney and 1 in the right kidney. The vagina was saturated with blood, the entrance of which was torn up to the labia majora. Sperm was found in her vagina. The anus was also wounded, with 2 cuts made to the mucous surface and the other on the sphincter. Most of these wounds measure between 9 to 16 millimeters. It was determined by the pathologist that the slashing movements made with the knife were struck in an upward trajectory. The depth of the wounds measured, in some cases, at 12 centimeters. A few hours after the body of Gertrude Alberman was found, a communist newspaper received a document that came to be known as the, quote, murder letter, end quote. It had been posted the day before in the evening. It described the location of her body. This wasn't the first occasion that such a communique was issued. On October 14th, the police received a message detailing a scenario wherein a body was interred at the edge of the forest. A plan containing details marking the exact spot where the body was left was included. On November 15th, the body of servant Maria Hahn was found. She was last seen in a beer garden with a man. She was stabbed 3 in the left temple, with wounds measuring between 11 to 13 millimeters. The wounds pierced through her skull and into her brain. Her neck was cut 7 times in 1 small spot, measuring at an area of 5 by 5 centimeter superficial wounds. She was stabbed 10 times in her chest, with the wounds covering an area measuring 13 to 22 centimeters. Each puncture was measured as being between 9 to 11 millimeters. 6 were superficial and 2 penetrated the heart. There were 2 in the pleurae. There was a small amount of blood, still in liquid form, in her pericardial sac, or the double-walled sac containing the heart and roots of the great vessels. Coagulated blood was found in the right pleura, measuring at 250 cubic centimeters. Her anus was violated digitally. Excrement and dried leaves were found inside her rectum. The rectum was stretched and left at a size of 12 centimeters in diameter. The pathologist determined that she was raped post-mortem. Stab wounds made in Hahn were estimated to have been made with the same knife that was used to stab the Alberman child. Part 6. The Offender. The murderer and rapist became careless. He was sloppy and brazen, almost inviting detection by law enforcement. His name was Peter Curtin. He told the story in his own words during his confession. This is how he detailed the scenario. On the 14th of May, 1930, I saw a man accost a young girl at the railway station and go off with her. Out of curiosity, I followed the couple along the Graf Adolf Strasse, the Karlstrasse, Klosterstrasse, Kölnerstrasse, Stofflerstrasse to the Volksgarten. When the man wanted to go into the dark park with the girl, she resisted him. I seized the opportunity and approached the couple. I asked him what he meant to do with the girl. He replied that the girl had no lodging and that he proposed to take her to his sister. At this point, the girl asked me whether the Achenbachstrasse was in that neighborhood. It was there the man's sister was supposed to live. When I assured her very convincingly that the street was in an entirely different neighborhood, she stepped to my side, and the man made off very quickly. We returned. The girl told me that she was out of work and had nowhere to go. She agreed to come with me to my room in the Mettmannerstrasse 71. Round about 11 o'clock, we got to my room, which is on the third floor. Then she suddenly said she didn't want any sexual intercourse and asked me whether I couldn't find her some other place to sleep. I agreed. We went by tram to Warringer Platz and on towards the Grafenberger Wald, going along the Wolfschott until we came to the last of the houses. Here I seized Butlies with one hand by the neck, pressing her head back very hard, and kissing her. I asked her to let me have her. I thought that under the circumstances she would agree, and my opinion was right. Afterwards, I asked whether I had hurt her, which she denied. I wanted to take her back to the tram, but I did not accompany her right to it, because I was afraid that she might inform the police officer who was standing there. I had no intention of killing Butlies. She had offered no resistance. We had sexual intercourse standing after I pulled down her knickers. There was another reason why I could not do anything to her. I had been seen by a friend in the tram. I did not think that Butlies would be able to find her way back again to my apartment in the rather obscure Mettmannerstrasse. So much the more was I surprised when on Wednesday, the 21st of May, I saw Butlies again in my house. Butlies was interviewed by police and corroborated the details given by Peter Curtin. She wrote a letter to Frau Brugmann about her experience. Brugmann suspected the perpetrator was the so-called Dusseldorf murderer. She took the letter to the criminal police department. Butlies was questioned and later found the house where Curtin was staying at the time. She had already spoke with several residents of Mettmannerstrasse, asking if they knew the man she was looking for. The man she described to them in intricate detail. Inhabitants of number 71 said that a crying girl once came running from the same direction where Butlies was attacked. She described the perpetrator as having identical features noted by Butlies. The description outlined the personage of Peter Curtin. He lived in number 71. Curtin commented on what happened next. On Wednesday, the 21st of May, I happened to look over the banisters and saw Butlies and recognized her. She can be recognized easily. She has very fair hair, is slant-eyed and bow-legged. She left the house again. At lunchtime, she came back, this time with a police officer. I saw her stand in the entrance door and speak to the landlady. Then in the afternoon, she came again to the house, this time coming up to our floor. She entered the flat of the Wimmers, and she saw me. She was startled. I think it is likely that she recognized me then. I knew what would happen after that. That same evening, I fetched my wife from the place where she worked. "I must get out of the flat," I said. I explained the Butlies case to her. But I only mentioned the attempt at sexual intercourse, saying that as it could be called rape, along with my previous convictions, it was enough to get me 15 years penal servitude. Therefore, I had to get out. I changed. Throughout the night, I walked about. On Thursday, the 22nd of May, I saw my wife in the morning in the flat. I fetched my things away in a bag and rented a room in the Adlerstrasse. I slept quietly until Friday morning. It was at 9 in the morning when I went to my flat. Shortly before I reached number 71, two men came out of it. I found out afterwards they were detectives. I thought right away that they were that. When I went into the flat, my wife was still there. When I asked her why she had not gone to work today, she answered, "I did, but I was taken away from it by two detectives who brought me home." Both these men had searched the place a few moments before they had gone down the staircase. Then my wife asked me to leave the house, saying she did not want me to be arrested there. I did as she asked and later met her. She had gone back to the place where she was employed. I then asked her to come with me for a little while. 2 days before, I had told her about the Butleys' affair. Today, the 23rd in the morning, I told my wife that I was also responsible for the Schulte affair, adding my usual remark that it would mean at least 10 years or more separation for us, probably forever. At that, my wife was inconsolable. She spoke of age, unemployment, lack of means, and starvation in old age. When the lunch hour approached, I had not even then succeeded in calming my wife down. She raved that I should take my life. Then she would do the same, since her future was completely without hope. Then in the late afternoon, I told my wife that I could help her, that I could still do something for her. I told her that I was the Dusseldorf murderer. Of course, she didn't think it possible and didn't want to believe it. But then I disclosed everything to her, naming myself the murderer in each case. When she asked me how this could help her, I hinted that a high reward had been offered for the discovery as well as for the capture of the criminal, that she could get hold of that reward, or at least some part of it, if she would report my confession and denounce me to the police. Of course, it wasn't easy for me to convince her that this ought not to be considered as treason, but that, on the contrary, she was doing a good deed to humanity as well as to justice. It was not until late in the evening that she promised me to carry out my request, and also that she would not commit suicide. I then accompanied her almost to the door. It was 2 o'clock when we separated. Back in the lodging, I went to bed and fell asleep at once. What happened the next morning, the 24th of May, is known. First to Bath, then several times around the neighborhood of the Kortzingen's flat, lunch, a haircut, and then at 3 o'clock, I met my wife according to the arrangement, and there the arrest took place. As a matter of fact, my wife had carried out my order a bit too quickly for me. I want to point out again that I never collapsed on the 23rd or 24th of May, but kept steadily before me my purpose to the very end. His wife's recollection of these events differed. In the morning, after the detectives had brought me from the place where I work, my husband came to the flat. "You must have done something awful," I said. "Yes," he replied. "I did it. I did everything." Then with that, he left the flat. We then met by arrangement at 11:30 in the morning in the Hofgarten. We had dinner in a restaurant in the Duisburger Strasse. I could not eat anything, but he ate up the lot, my portion too. At 2 o'clock, we were walking over the Rhine Bridge back and forwards. In the late afternoon, I asked him what he meant with his words, "I have done everything." "If you promise solemnly that you won't give me away, I'll tell you something," he said. I promised. "I have done everything that has happened here in Dusseldorf." "What do you mean by that?" I asked. "Everything. The murders and the attacks." "What? Those innocent children too?" I asked. "Yes," he said. "Why did you do that?" I asked him. "I don't know myself," he replied. "It just came over me." Then all the big cases were talked over, including that of Mulheim. When I got terribly excited about it all, he said, "I've done something very silly. I ought not to have told you." That afternoon, Curtin was very depressed, and in a way I had never seen before. He told me that he had not cried once in his whole life, but yesterday evening, when he was alone, he had cried bitterly. In the afternoon, while he spoke only about the fact that the detectives were after him, he was quiet and self-possessed. But towards the evening, when I wanted to go home, he was as I have never seen him in this life before. He was very cast down. He could not look into my eyes. All the indifference had disappeared. He burst out with it all, telling of the murders and the attacks, as if some power forced him to do it. I thought he had gone crazy. Nothing had been said about any reward. Frau Curtin notified police that she would be meeting her husband in the Rokas Church Square on May 24th. As he approached her, the police ambushed him. He was arrested without incident and taken to police headquarters. During questioning, Curtin not only opened up about the murders he committed, but he confessed to every crime he had ever committed. Part 7. The Genesis of a Murderer. Peter Curtin was born in 1883 in Köln, Mülheim, and spent his childhood there. He moved to Düsseldorf in 1894. He served an apprenticeship as a molder in 1897. He became a criminal in 1899. His charges: one charge of theft, 1899. Three charges of arson, 1904. Curtin was incarcerated from 1905 to 1913. More charges: attempted strangulation of Margaret Schaefer, 1913. Murder by strangulation and throat cutting of Christine Klein, 1913. Axe blow to an unknown man, 1913. Axe blow to an unknown woman, 1913. Attempted axe blow to Frau Hermes, 1913. Strangulation of Gertrude Franken, 1913. Arson of a hay rick and hay wagon, 1913. Curtin was incarcerated from 1913 to 1921. Yet more charges: strangulation of unnamed war widow, 1921. Strangulation of a victim identified by the surname Taida, 1925. Strangulation of a victim identified by the surname Meck, 1929. Strangulation of a victim identified by the surname Kiefer, 1929. Strangulation of a victim identified by the surname Wack, 1926. Arson of three hayricks, 1927. Arson of a shock of sheaves, 1927. Arson of two barns, 1927. Attempted strangulation of Annie Ist, 1927. Arson of two barns, 1927. Arson of a plantation, 1927. Arson of a barn, 1928. Arson of a farmyard, 1928. Arson of two shocks of sheave, two separate incidents in 1928. Arson of a hayrick, 1928. Arson of a hay wagon, 1928. Arson of a house, 1928. Arson of a shed, 1928. Ignition of a forest fire, 1928. Arson of haystacks, 1928. Arson of sheds, 1928. Arson of sheds, 1929. Arson of barns, sheds, and stacks, 1929. Attack with scissors on Frau Kuhn, February 3, 1929. Stabbed and killed Rudolf Scheer, February 13, 1929. Strangled the child Rose Olinger and stabbed her post-mortem, March 8, 1929. Attempted strangulation of Edith Buchhorn, March 1929. Attempted strangulation of Maria Witt, July 1929. Attempted strangulation of Maria Mass, July 1929. Attempted strangulation of an unnamed domestic servant, July 1929. Strangled and stabbed Maria Hahn to death, August 1929. Strangled and drowned a housemaid known as Annie, August 1929. Stabbed Anna Goldhausen with a dagger, August 1929. Stabbed Frau Mantel with a dagger, August 1929. Stabbed an individual known as Kornblum with a dagger, August 1929. Strangled and cut the throat of a child named Hamaker, August 1929. Strangled and stabbed a child named Lenzen, August 1929. Stabbed Gertrude Schult with a dagger, August 1929. Attempted to strangle and throw a victim known as Heer into a river, August 1929. Struck a blow at a victim known as Ruck with a tool, September 1929. Attempted to strangle Maria Rad, September 1929. Killed Ida Reuter with a hammer, September 1929. Killed Elizabeth Dorier with a hammer, October 1929. Attacked Frau Meurer with a hammer, October 1929. attacked Frau Wanders with a hammer, October 1929. Strangled and stabbed the child Olbermann, November 1929. Attempted strangulation of victim known as Hilda, February 1930. Attempted strangulation of Marianne Del Santo, March 1930. Attempted strangulation of the victim known as Irma, March 1930. Attempted strangulation of victim known as Sybil, April 1930. Attempted strangulation of an unnamed girl from Hearn, April 1930. Attempted strangulation of a young woman known as Howe, April 1930. More attacks on young girls, April 1930. Attacked Charlotte Ulrich, April 1930. Attempted to strangle Maria Butleys, May 1930. Attempted murder of Gertrude Bell, May 1930. According to the police, Curtin relished the looks of horror on their faces as Curtin listed and described his grisliest offenses. It was difficult for them to stomach, and it lasted for days. Transcriptions of Curtin's confessions were retained and released to the public. These statements are excerpts from his confessions. In November 1899, I picked up an 18-year-old girl in the Alleystrasse. I went with her to the Hofgarten, past the zoo, to the Grafenberger Wald, as far as Rolandsburg. On the way home, amid lovely country, I throttled her. I left her lying there, supposing her to be dead, and heard no more of her. In June 1913, I picked up a girl on the Bremsstrasse and took her out on several subsequent occasions. One Sunday we went to a dance at Gerresheim. On the way home, I throttled the girl several times. When she was scared, I said, "That's what love's like. I won't kill you, though." After that, she put up with it. We had sexual connection on a bench. This is how Margaret Schaefer described her experience with Peter Curtin when she testified at his trial. "We walked in the woods the whole night. Curtin would not let me go home. He had my bag with the keys in it. He wanted to kiss me, and he knocked me about, afterwards becoming friendly again. Then he threw me onto a bench and tried to have sexual intercourse with me. In the struggle, my dress got torn, and I cried, and then he became kinder again. I looked simply awful, and in that state, could not have taken the tram. We sat on a bench. Curtin threw his coat about us both, and we fell asleep. Dawn came, and I woke him up. Then he started again as before, tore off my earrings, bit me, half strangled me, pulling my hair out in handfuls. He looked like the very devil himself. I begged him to calm down, otherwise he would end up in hell. My words had some effect, and he did calm down. He made me swear that I would not tell anything to anybody we might meet. We came eventually to the Rolandsburg. Curtin had breakfast there. I went to the waiters who were sitting in another room and told them of the jam I was in. One Sunday evening, it was a feast day. I searched for a suitable house and came at length to the Wolfstrasse. I broke into a house in this street, an inn owned by Klein. I went up to the first floor. This was about 10 or 11 o'clock. I opened different doors, but found nothing worth stealing. In a room facing the stairs, there was a bed in the left corner near the window where I entered. It was a large bed in which adults could sleep. In the room were also a cupboard and a table. So much light came through the window from the street that I could see clearly everything in the room. In the bed I saw a sleeping girl of about 10, covered with a thick feather bed. She was lying with her head towards the window. I seized her by the neck with my hands and throttled her for 1 or 2 minutes. The child woke up, struggled to free herself, scratched my hand, and then became unconscious and still. Her arms were thrown up above her head. I then drew her head over the edge of the bed and threw the feather bed to the foot of it. With one or two fingers, I penetrated the genitals. With a small but sharp pocket knife, I made a deep cut in the throat of the child. I started on the left side of the throat, drawing the knife to the right with the right hand. I heard the blood gurgle up and drip on the mat. It spattered my hand. The whole business did not take more than 3 minutes. I then left the room and made off. Details from the autopsy of the Klein child. The skin was pallid. The tongue was bitten. There were blue-red bruises on her face. There were two wounds on her neck, measuring 1 to 2 millimeters deep, 9 centimeters long. There were scratches and nail imprints on her neck. There was a tear running from the vagina across the perineum to the anus, with several tears extending to the mucous membrane of the upper vaginal passage. The bronchial tubes were filled with blood. Curtin describes more of his offenses. One Saturday evening in June 1913, I left home at 8 o'clock and set out for Gerresheim. From a cellar under the Holy Trinity Church, I took a chopper. At about 11 o'clock, I saw an unaccompanied girl enter a house. In the passage, I gave her a sharp and heavy blow on the head so that she crumpled up without a murmur. The girl was about 1.68 meters tall, slim, and between 18 and 20 years of age. In July 1913, I went with the chopper to Gerresheim about 9 o'clock in the evening. After a long search, I saw a man sitting on a bench in the park. I crept up to him and hit him on the head, and he collapsed without a sound. On my way back, I set fire to a cart laden with hay. In July 1913, I went up to the first floor of the house on the corner of the Munster and Ullmannstrasse. I had a chopper with me. I had been to the house once already to steal. I was just about to cleave through the head of the 16-year-old girl when a man jumped out of bed. I ran away, throwing the chopper on the bed as I ran. At about 9 o'clock in the evening on Saturday in July 1913, I set out for the house of the Loschecks. I had a skeleton key with me, and with it gained entrance to the first floor. I went into a room and up to the bed and strangled one of the children lying in it for some time. I left the room and went home again. There were 3 beds in the room. The girl I throttled was, I reckon, 16 or 17 years old. She did not scream or shout. I met Tita and had sexual relations with her in the room where she was employed in the Bodenstrasse. I got something good to eat there too, and I could do with it, for I had at that time to work pretty hard. A week after meeting Tita, I became acquainted with Meck, a housemaid in a situation on the Bergischen Landstrasse. There, too, I got something to eat. I often grabbed Tita by the throat and seized hold of her. When she got angry with me, I used to try and pacify her. That's what love means, I told her. She let herself be calmed down. I had not told her my real name, and I had pretended to be younger by 10 years, and that I had a better job than I really had. Then my wife came along, and Tita realized that I was married and gave me away to the police. I got 2 months imprisonment for attempted seduction. During the trial, I defended myself vigorously against the charge, but I got the 2 months and did it in 1927. Then Meck and Tita met, and Meck cut up rough and charged me with rape, but I was acquitted. Then she charged me with using threats and insulting behavior. For that, I got 8 months imprisonment. I served 6 months, 2 being remitted on my undertaking to leave Dusseldorf, That wasn't so easy, so I wrote to the ministry with the result that the condition was canceled. In the summer of 1925, I picked up Maria Kiefer in the Parkstrasse. We made an appointment for the following evening. I went to her place, as agreed upon, and there Kiefer waited for me at the front door. That was about 10 o'clock. She took me with her into the wash house in the cellar, where we had sexual intercourse, but not without her consent. Then I seized her by the throat and strangled her. But Kiefer managed to escape from the grip of my hands and cried out. So I left the house quickly. In the spring of 1926, I picked up Maria Wack in the Duisburger Strasse. We went into the Hofgarten and talked about our personal affairs. We met frequently after that, and one Sunday we went to the Grafenberger Wald. There I attempted to force her backwards on a bench while I seized her throat. As she put up a resistance, I abandoned the attempt and left her on the bench. I never saw her again. Maria gave a statement of her own. In June 1926, I became acquainted with a man who called himself Fritz Kettler. I was cleaning the doorstep when he accosted me. We made an appointment, and inside 3 weeks we had been out 5 times. Kettler was an employee of the railway and behaved decently in every way. One Sunday he suggested that we should go to the Grafenberg. Dusk had fallen in the woods, and we were passing a bench when he suddenly seized me, flung me on it, and groped with his hand under my skirt. I defended myself. Apparently passers-by frightened him, for he desisted. I jumped up, grabbed his hat, and ran away. He called after me, asking for his hat. He then exchanged his hat for mine, and made the remark that I ought to be human. There he left me standing, and made off. In the summer of 1927, I picked up a girl named Annie Ist on the Bremstrasse. From then on, I saw her frequently. On a Saturday evening, we went into the Grafenberger Wald. We had sexual intercourse on a bench. I then seized its neck and strangled her. But she was a robust girl and managed to free herself. She ran away screaming. Her dress had been torn at the neck. Annie Ist gave her version. Curtin's statement is correct. He called himself Kettler. Mettmanner Strasse, 71. We met each other several times. On one occasion, it ended with sexual intercourse. At the end of July 1927, we went to a fair at Roth and returned through the Grafenberger Wald. It was there that we had sexual relations. But when Curtin wanted intercourse a second time, I demurred, but at last gave in. After intercourse, he strangled me without any reason, bashed my face, and tore my dress from my neck. Nevertheless, I asked him to take me home, which he did. We met each other several times again, but there were no more sexual relations. I got some information about him and discovered that his name was not Kettler, and that he was a married man, so I broke off our relationship. When I saw in the newspapers the photograph of the Dusseldorf murderer, I recognized him instantly, but I did not denounce him to the police. On a Sunday evening, I strolled about the neighborhood of the Hellweg in search of a victim. I had pocketed a pair of scissors for this purpose. Towards 6 o'clock, I saw a woman going along the Bertestrasse. I went up to her and shouted, "Stop!" And then, "No noise!" Then, with the scissors, I stabbed her blindly. I left her lying unconscious. I heard cries for help and made my way quickly down the Hellweg. When I was cleaning the scissors at home, I noticed that from one blade, the pointed part had been broken off about 8 to 10 millimeters. I had thought that the stabs were much deeper. On the 8th of February, 1929, I left home at about 6 o'clock at night. I went towards St. Vincent's Church, where I met a girl between 8 and 10 years of age. I asked her where she wanted to go. She said, home. I asked, where do you live? She said, in the Langerstrasse. I said, come then, I'll take you home. I took her by the hand and led her along the Kettwigerstrasse as far as a hoarding. Here I seized the child's throat, strangled her, and put her on her back. With my right hand, I drew the scissors out and stabbed the child in the left temple and in different places about the heart. The child seemed to be dead. I went back to my flat and searched myself for blood stains. I also cleaned the scissors. There were no blood stains on my clothing. Then I went to the movies as I still had a free ticket, and then home again. I filled a beer bottle with petroleum. We have a petroleum lamp. And then went to the scene of the crime with the object of pouring it over the body and setting fire to it. But there were too many people about. I therefore lent the bottle against the hoarding and went home. The next morning, at 6 o'clock, I got up and told my wife I had to go to the WC. I ran quickly to the scene of the crime, poured the petroleum over the body, and set it on fire. There and back did not take me more than 5 or 6 minutes. I felt no sexual excitement and did not touch the girl. My motive was only to cause excitement and indignation. I wanted to increase the general indignation by setting light to the victim. I did not masturbate on the corpse, nor did I even touch the child sexually. The place where I first throttled and stabbed the child is only 1 or 2 meters from where I put her down. When I strangled her, she was standing. I took 2 or 3 paces with her towards the hoarding. I had both hands on her neck and dragged her with her feet on the ground. On the 12th of February, 1929, I left home about 8 o'clock in the evening, and for 3 hours I searched in vain for a victim. My wife, I knew, would be returning home about 1 o'clock. Then, in the Hellweg, I ran into a man. He seemed to be drunk and noisy. He shoved me. "What do you want?" he asked. I looked at his hands to see whether he was armed. Then, with the flat of my hand, I struck him in the neck. He went over backwards and fell flat on his face. I took the scissors and gave him a heavy stab with them. He grabbed for my legs and, half lying, half kneeling in front of me, clung to me. I next stabbed him in the right temple and again in the neck. At one stab in the back, my scissors stuck, and I could hardly get them out again. After another stab in the back, I heard the blood spouting. Shear collapsed. He relaxed his hold on my leg and lay face downwards. Even in the dark, I could see the large pool of blood. I grabbed his feet and dragged him towards the ditch and shoved him until he rolled down. After that, I wanted to go home, but after taking 30 steps or so, I turned back and cleaned the uppers of Shear's boots to obliterate the traces of my fingerprints. The whole thing didn't take me more than 8 minutes, one of which I spent standing over Shear before I dragged him to the ditch. Next day at 8 o'clock, I returned to the scene of the crime. On my way back, I met a detective and opened a conversation with him. He, too, probably was going to the place where the murder had been committed, for detectives were already standing there. The detective looked at me suspiciously. "How had I come to know of the crime?" he inquired. I told him I had heard of it by telephone. Meanwhile, we had come to the cordon, and I was stopped. During the first half of July 1929, I picked up a servant girl named Maria Witt on the Grunerstrasse. We chatted pleasantly and made an appointment. Several times we met in the Heinrichstrasse. One Sunday I fetched her to go to Kaiserswerth. Suddenly on the Grofrichstrasse, my wife came up from behind us with the words, "Ha ha, so you've got yourself a new wife, have you?" With the rose that Maria had brought me from the garden of her employer, I gave my wife a smack on the cheek. Then, without a single word, I turned and left both the women standing there, the scissors I had in my pocket. That Sunday, after I had left my wife, Anne Maria Witt, I picked up another girl and asked her to come with me to the Heer Turf Festival. We remained there for some time. I bought some peaches, and then we strolled towards the Rhine. We sat there and talked. Meanwhile, dusk had fallen. Suddenly, I gripped her neck and strangled her violently, but she freed herself and ran into a tent nearby. Maria Mass commented on this encounter. When the man accosted me and introduced himself, I only caught his Christian name, Fritz, and that he was a post office official. He behaved in every way like a gentleman. We went to the festival, and there he bought peaches. We also went to a beer garden, and afterwards we strolled towards the Rhine. He asked me repeatedly for a kiss, but when it darkened, I wanted to go home. On that, he gripped my neck and, without a word, compressed it. I freed myself and ran towards a little tent. For days, 5 impressions of the nails of his hand were visible on my neck. On the same evening, I picked up a girl on the Oberkassler Brook who called herself Annie. We went to a beer garden. Annie said that she came from Westphalia. When darkness fell, I strangled her throat until I thought she was dead. Then I dragged her along the bank and threw her into the Rhine. On the 8th of August, 1929, I was strolling in the zoo district. I hadn't any intention of committing any offense on a girl at the time. On the Hansa Platz, a girl was sitting on a bench. She accosted me. I sat down beside her and we talked pleasantly together and made a date for an excursion to the Neanderthal the next Sunday. On Sunday, punctually at 1:30 in the afternoon, I found myself in the Hansa Platz, where the girl was already waiting. We went to the Neanderthal, visited a beer garden, and then on to the Stinter Mill. We stayed there for 3 hours, drank a glass of red wine each. There also I bought her a slab of chocolate. Towards 7 o'clock we went to Erkroth, where we had supper with beer. We then strolled past the House of the Morps and along by the river. Here we decided to have sexual intercourse. After sexual intercourse, we left the bank of the river and went into the meadow. Here I decided to kill her. I led Han to a big bush near a ditch, and there we settled down. It was 9:30. Suddenly, I strangled her until she became unconscious, but she came to herself quickly again. Again, I strangled her. After a bit, I stabbed her in the throat with the scissors. She lost a lot of blood, but regained consciousness, repeatedly asking me in a feeble voice to spare her life. I stabbed her in the breast, a blow that probably pierced the heart. I then gave her repeated stabs in the breast and head. The process of dying probably took an hour. I let the body roll into the ditch and threw branches over it. Then I crossed the meadow and came to the road that runs from Morp-Papendal Highway. I had taken the handbag of Han with me. From it, I took the watch of the dead girl. I made a gift of it to somebody later on. The bag with the keys I threw into an oat field. When I got home, my wife was already in bed. Next morning, we had a row because she was suspicious about the night before. She became so excited about it that I made up my mind that I would have to find some way of seeing that the body of Han wasn't discovered, otherwise my wife would connect the bloodstains on my clothes with it. So I went again on Monday after finishing work to the scene of the crime and pondered where I could bury the body. I went back to the flat and fetched a shovel, inventing an excuse to give my wife. Near the scene of the crime, in the corner of the wood, I dug a deep hole in a fallow field and carried the body along the footpath, avoiding the outfield. By the hole, I put the body down. I got into the hole and dragged the body down to me. Here I laid it on its back as one buries a body. A shoe had slipped off when the body was dragged down. and I laid it beside it. Then I filled the hole. During the whole of this funeral ceremony, a sentimental feeling possessed me. I caressed the hair, and the first shovelful of earth I strewed thinly and gently on the body. I stamped the earth down and smoothed the soil as it was before. As my shirt had become bloody in carrying the body, I took it off and washed it in the river and put it on again, still wet. I hid the shovel near the river. Then I went home and arrived there about 6 o'clock. My wife began reproaching me, asked me where I had been wandering all the night. I had cleaned my shoes thoroughly in the grass, using a cleaning rag which I always carried with me. I then drank coffee and went to work in the same clothes. After I had put the body of Han in the grave, I removed her wristwatch. 4 weeks later, I gave the watch to Kaite W. W lives in the same house where I live. She often came into my room, and we repeatedly had sexual intercourse. Kaite W. later denied Curtin's claim that they had a sexual encounter. She identified as a virgin whose vagina had an enlarged introitus, or the opening that leads to the vaginal canal. Curtin confessed to more murders. On the day of the coronation ball at the Lehrenfelder Festival, I worked overtime until 10 p.m. I went to the Schützenplatz on the Erkrathersstrasse in search of a victim. I watched the young girls, how they went home in different directions. I followed two, and presently they stopped before a street door. I passed them thinking that one would probably go on. I crossed to the other side of the street and saw that one girl had gone on. I went back again to the other side of the street, keeping my dagger in readiness. I stabbed the girl in the left breast. It was the girl Goldhausen. She collapsed without a sound. I then went off with the dagger unsheathed. I heard cries for help. When I went down the Erkrathersstrasse, I saw a woman coming along. I offered her my company. The woman did not answer, but crossed the road. I followed her and stabbed her twice in the back from behind. I then went across the field path. I saw a man lying in a ditch and just about to crawl up the bank. I gave him a stab in the back. I sheathed the dagger and hid it near the Erkrathersstrasse. I watched how the physician and ambulance arrived and how a crowd of curious people gathered round. I pictured to myself the indignation of the population, and then went home. It was 2:30. On the 24th of August, I went out about 8 o'clock and took the dagger with me. I had heard that the festival was on in Fleja. Until 10 o'clock, I was on the lookout for a victim on the streets of Fleja. I saw two girls. They went down a field path. I followed them and told the bigger girl to fetch me from a kiosk 4 cigarettes for 20 pfennigs. She ran off and I stayed behind with the smaller girl. I seized her by the throat, took her over my arm, and carried her across the field to another small field path where beans grew. Here I put down the Hamaker child, who was now unconscious, drew my dagger from my pocket, and slit her throat. I stood over the body of the child with my legs apart and cut from my left to the right. I returned the dagger to the sheath, put the sheath into my hip pocket. I went back to the place where Lenzen, the bigger girl, had left us. She gave me the cigarettes. I seized her by the throat and strangled her. With my left arm, I seized her round the body and carried her, still throttling her, down the path, round the bean patch to the garden, so that I was hidden by the beans. I loosened my right hand. Lenzen slumped down. I realized that she was not quite unconscious. She moved about and began to scream. I then seized her throat with my left hand, and holding her down like that, I drew the dagger from my pocket with my right hand, and in that position, I stabbed her in the breast and side. I then relaxed my grip. Lenzen sank to the ground. Then I made off, and at 11:30, I was home again. My wife was still awake. We talked quite naturally. There were no blood stains on me. Neither were my hands bloody. On the way home, I had cleaned my dagger with a rag I found. If Lenzen was found in some other position, then she must have moved of her own volition. I left her lying on her back. On the way to the scene of the crime, she defended herself vigorously, lashing out with hands and feet. On the following Sunday, the 25th of August, I went once more to Flea to savor the effect of my crime. I listened to the various accounts given by the inhabitants, going from group to group of excited people, listening to them. It gave me pleasure that the lovely bright Sunday in Dusseldorf had been shattered as by a lightning stroke. Just about that time, my obsession was rather strong upon me. Feeling fairly sure that I would be successful in finding a victim on that day, I had pocketed my dagger. I crossed the Rhine Bridge to Oberkassel, and there accosted a young girl. Together we went to Nice, where the fair was in progress. I suggested that we should take the path across the Rhine Meadows on the homeward way. As we went along, we repeatedly embraced and kissed each other. We sat down near the Rhine, and I caressed her, but she refused me sexual intercourse. I knelt beside her, caressed with my left hand her hair, then I seized my dagger with my right hand and attempted to cut her throat. She shouted out loudly and struggled hard. Then, blindly, I went on stabbing her. Her shouts, however, attracted people who called out, "What's the matter?" I went off, but remained standing in a ditch nearby, and so saw how Schult was found by some people. I went quietly over the dam to the Rhine Bridge. I could still hear them calling, "Quick, police!" At the last stab, I noticed that my dagger was broken, therefore I threw it away. In Oberkassel, I took Schult's bag from my breast pocket, took out the watch and a picture, and threw the bag in a garden. Sitting on a bench, I awaited the arrival of the police. I was curious to know how much time would elapse before they arrived. Some 20 minutes passed, and the thought of the police busy with my victim relieved my tension. I thought that certainly Schult would die of her wounds. Under the bright light of the street lamp, I examined my clothes for blood, and then I went home. There was no blood on me. Gertrude Schult's version of the event. Curtin had been decent to the very end. There was no talk of kissing until after we had settled down. Then he tried to pull off my knickers and threw me backwards. This tussle did not last more than 2 minutes. He suddenly released me, held me by one hand, and said, "Come, see if you can feel it. I've only a small tail." Then he threw himself on top of me and knelt between my legs. I threatened to scream. He said, "You can shout here as much as you like. Nobody will hear you." Obviously, Curtin had not noticed a tent nearby. He laughed when I said, "Let me die." "Then you shall die," he replied. I felt a cut on my throat and shrieked. I felt another painful stab in my back, and then became unconscious. It was on a Saturday, and I picked up a girl in the railway station. We went to Schumacher's and drank a glass of beer, and then walked in the Hofgarten until 1 o'clock in the morning. Lena seemed prepared to go home with me. As the last train had gone, we went along the banks of the Dussel, through Flingern to the Ostpark. There I seized Lena's throat and strangled her. She defended herself stoutly, at which I released her again, but I strangled her again and at last pushed her into the Dussel. Lena's take. I met a man who promised to find some digs for me. On the banks of the Dussel, he tried to rape me. When he did not succeed, he pushed me in the Dussel. I only just managed to save myself. In the autumn of 1929, I met a couple in the Rothstrasse. I wanted to interfere, so I hit the man over the head with a chisel. The man ran away. Then I hit the girl several times with a chisel. She fell down. I went off. That is not how Sophie Ruck remembered it. Her recollection. I was cycling on the Rossstrasse. From a side street, a man rushed out, dragged me off my bicycle, and hit me on the head. For a short while, I was unconscious. Then people came. It was on the 31st of August, 1929, at 10 o'clock. I was most certainly alone. Towards the end of September, 1929, at 8 o'clock in the evening, I waited for a victim on the Dreherstrasse, but not until about midnight did I see a woman approaching. I walked towards her, seized her throat, and strangled her. We both fell down the bank into the field. I felt for the woman's sexual parts through her clothing. She shouted loudly for help. So, I cleared out. I was chased. It was the only time I was ever pursued. Rod's version. Curtin seized my sexual parts and wrenched them round so that they were swollen. Otherwise, his evidence was true. One Sunday, I left home at 6 o'clock in the evening. I had pocketed a hammer. At the railway station, I saw a young girl, accosted her, and proposed a walk. We had a beer at Schumacher's and walked through the Hofgarten and over the Rhine Bridge to the Poplar Wood. During this walk, night had fallen. Reuter hesitated to go any further. Therefore, we turned back. Midway between the top of the wood and the playground, having made sure that nobody was around, I pulled the hammer from my hip pocket and hit the girl on the right temple. For that purpose, I had moved to the right side of Reuter. Without a sound, she collapsed. People were approaching from the wood. I dragged Reuter from the dam down to the meadows. Here I waited until the people had passed. Meanwhile, she had regained consciousness. She said, "Let me alone." Then I dragged her a good deal further. I gave her other hammer blows on the head and misused her. I pulled off her knickers to wash my hands with them in the Rhine. I left Reuter and went back to the Hansalie, taking her little case with me. From it, I took a ring for some future girl acquaintance. After I got to the Rhine Bridge, I returned to the scene of the crime in order to drag Reuter down to the Rhine. I thought she was dead. I seized her legs and dragged her towards the riverbank. But I noticed a man with a dog, so I cleared off again. I left home on a weekday, about 9 o'clock in the evening, putting the hammer in my hip pocket. By the Residenz Theater, I met a young, slim girl, who later told me her name was Dorier. I asked her to come for a walk. At first, she did not want to. In the end, she went with me to Schumacher's. We went by tram to Grafenberg and walked along the banks of the Dussel. Dorier was on my left. Suddenly, I gave her a violent blow on the right temple. In order to do so, I stepped back. Without a sound, Dorier collapsed. I grabbed her wrist and dragged her several meters from the path. I then used her sexually after having pulled off her knickers from one leg. I then gave her more heavy blows with a hammer on the head. After the first blow, she didn't say anything more, but only groaned. I took off her cloak and also the hat, which was very bloody. I hid these things in the bushes. You can see from that how excited I was. I left home at 8 o'clock in the evening. The hammer I used on Reuter and Dorier I had hidden outside. I fetched it and pocketed it. In the Bruckstrasse, I noticed a woman going down the dark Hellwig. I followed her and overtook her near the first new building. I started a conversation about the Egyptian darkness of the Hellwig and about the general unsafety. We arrived at the railway arch. As I knew these surroundings pretty well, I had by that time made up my mind to commit the crime there. I stepped to the right side of Frau Meurer, took a step back and gave her a heavy blow with the hammer on the right temple. I don't know whether I actually hit the temple. The woman collapsed without a sound. I gave her more hammer blows as she lay on the ground. I took her attaché case and went back down the hallway. Later on, I threw away the case. After the Moira, I did not go home but to the Hofgarten. I was accosted by a woman smoking a cigarette, who asked me to go with her. I went with her to the Annisberg, where the path was concealed by bushes. Here, Wander stopped in order to have sexual intercourse with me. I turned her round, meanwhile taking the hammer from my hip pocket, and struck her on the right temple. Without a sound, Wanders collapsed and fell over the low railings. I then gave her several further blows on the head. In doing that, the handle of the hammer broke, and the head flew off into the bushes. I left Wanders lying where she was, and went on. Wanders was repulsive to me, for I knew she was a professional prostitute, and I never accost that kind of girl. After a quarter of an hour, I returned to the place and searched in vain for the hammer. On the 27th of November, 1929, I set out with a pair of scissors about 5 o'clock at night. I met a little girl at the Ackerstrasse. I talked to her and asked her quietly if she could come with me. We went into the open across some allotments as far as the wall of the Haniels place. The child went with me quite willingly and did not cry. I seized the child's throat and strangled it. I stabbed it in the left temple. The child collapsed without a sound. With my left hand, I held fast to her throat, knelt down, and stabbed the child's breast with my scissors. With the right hand, I felt the vagina, after having removed the knickers. Then I carried the body a few meters towards the Lennelstrasse and put it into the stinging nettles. I cleaned my hands on the wet grass. It was raining. There were no bloodstains on me. I met a girl in the Schadelstrasse. We went to Schumacher's and then to Grothenburg. We spoke about sexual relations on a bench. She was very nervous. Suddenly at midnight, I seized her by the throat and strangled her. She defended herself vigorously. I had sexual intercourse with her lying on the bench. I then accompanied her to her flat in the Kronachstrasse. She promised she would not say anything about the strangling. On the following Sunday, the 2nd of March, I went again to the Kronachstrasse to make sure that Hildegard had not reported the matter to anyone. She was already leaning out of the window waiting for me. Together we visited several beer gardens. Then we went to my flat, undressed, and went to bed. Before we had had sexual intercourse, my wife returned unexpectedly. She remained quite quiet, merely asking the girl to dress herself, after which she took her back to the Kronachstrasse. In the middle of March 1930, I offered to treat a girl to beer at Schumacher's. She told me she was not averse from perversions. We decided to practice some of these, and for that purpose we went to the Grothenburger Wald. There I suddenly strangled her. She defended herself. I could have anything I liked from her. I answered, "I don't want anything from you," and strangled her again, but she managed to free herself and ran off. Marianne Del Santo gave a statement about this incident. Curtin introduced himself to me as a well-to-do bachelor. He said I could sleep very nicely in his villa out of town. In the woods, I wanted to turn back. He then suddenly seized me from behind by the neck and threw me to the ground and strangled me. I tried to appease him, but like lightning, he seized me again. I fell to the ground. He stood over me without his legs spread. I kicked at him with my feet. I managed to release myself. I ran away and hid in the bushes. There I crouched from 10 o'clock till 6 in the morning. For hours, I heard people passing the bushes, but I didn't see anybody. In March 1930, I set out with the scissors. At the railway station, a girl accosted me. I took her with me to Schumacher's and went with her to the Grothenburger Wald. She called herself Irma and I reckon she was between 22 and 24 years old and about 168 centimeters high. Near the Hirschberg, I seized her by the throat and throttled her violently. She defended herself vigorously and screamed. I pushed her down the bank to the Wolf Ravine and cleared out. Becker's version. I arrived in Dusseldorf from Cologne and was accosted by a gentleman. We wanted to go to his flat. While in the woods, I still believed that we were on the way to his flat. Curtin then said that he had only enticed me there and tried to pull me down to a bench, pulled my dress up, tore my knickers down, and seized my sexual parts. I defended myself and rearranged my clothes. He then wanted to lead me further on by the arm. After a few steps, he pushed me forcibly down the slope. I called for help and rolled over and over several times until I reached the bottom. I had broken my umbrella, beating Curtin when he tried to rape me. On the 30th of March, 1930, I picked up a girl in the Königssalle. We chatted together on a bench in the Hofgarten. Then we agreed to take a walk together on Sunday in the woods. During this walk, we had sexual intercourse on a bench, and I strangled her. As there were passers-by, I cleared off. At the station, I accosted a graceful girl about 20 years old and 165 centimeters in height. We went to a cafe, and from there to Oberkassel. In a deserted place, I suddenly strangled her. She cried out loudly for help. I released her and made my way back to the station. When I alighted, I saw that the girl was alighting too. The following Sunday, I saw her again in the Graf Adolf Strasse. I turned up Steinstrasse. Suddenly, somebody seized me by the arm. "You come along with me to a policeman." I recognized the girl instantly and said, "What about you coming with me to the policeman too, to tell him about my purse, which you stole within 30 marks in it?" With that, I threw her off. One Friday, I became acquainted with a girl 30 years of age in the Königssalle. I went with her into a care and then to the Hofgarten. We sat there until 11 o'clock. Suddenly, I gripped her under her clothes. She smacked me in the face. I smacked her back. Hal gave a statement about this incident. I became acquainted with a nice man, a builder's assistant, named Franz Becker. In the Hofgarten, he made love to me. He drew me towards him and tried to feel me under my skirt. With my clenched fist, I punched his eye. He punched back with his fist so that my mouth bled. He said, "Is that what I get for treating you in the cafe?" I gave him 3 marks, and he gave me back 2 marks, 15 pfennigs. He kissed the blood from my mouth. He wanted to detain me longer, but I ran away. He shouted after me, "Consider yourself lucky that we are not alone in the Hofgarten." At 9 o'clock, I picked up a girl in the street and went with her to Schumacher's, and afterwards to the Grafenberger Wald. I lulled her suspicions by saying that there were always couples there. Where there is a broad view, I gave her a blow with a hammer on the right temple. She collapsed, screaming loudly. I left her lying there. I saw this girl several times after that, the last time on the Wednesday before my arrest. The hammer I used was similar to the one I had used before. I struck with it several times, and I saw the blood flow. In the Schadowstrasse, I became acquainted with a girl, and we made an appointment for the following evening in the Rhine Park. We attempted to have sexual intercourse there on a bench, but there were too many people about. We therefore made an appointment for the following Sunday at Nordfriedhof. There was a sudden thunderstorm came on, so Gertrude took me to her room. We had relations on her bed, but her mistress came knocking at the door, asking all kinds of questions. We then agreed on a meeting in her room for the 24th of May. Meanwhile, I was arrested. Gertrude Bell's take. Curtin called himself Franz Wiedlich from the tramway depot. After we had sexual intercourse, Wiedlich was very nervous. I asked him to spend the night with me, but unsuccessfully. On the following Thursday, I met him at the Waringer Platz. There he said that I was far too good for him, that, after all, I didn't know him at all, and that he was a bad man. In court, Curtin made the following statements. Mr. Examining Magistrate, you can take it as so, but believe me that if I tell you the whole truth, you will hear a lot of horrible things from me. Curtin stated that his motive for committing these atrocities was to exact revenge against society for the tortures and indignities he suffered in prison. The judge asked him if he had a conscience. Curtin said, I have none. Never have I felt any misgiving in my soul. Never did I think to myself that what I did was bad, even though human society condemns it. As I have figured it out, when I am executed, my blood and the blood of my victims will be on the heads of my torturers, that is, if there is such a thing as a higher justice. I have thought of the law of cause and effect, and on the law of the sufficient motive. There must be a higher being who gave in the first place the first vital spark to life. That higher being would also deem my actions good, since I revenged injustice. The punishments I have suffered have destroyed all my feelings as a human being. That was why I had no pity for my victims. Curtin made this statement in the presence of a magistrate on another occasion. I said before that I had no conscience, but I have got one. I felt it often, even in these last years. It was when I committed adultery. Then I often thought how wrong it was of me with so hard-working a wife. Part 8. Prison. Regarding the treatment Curtin received in prison that drove him to punish society, he said it was the lengthy periods of being held in restraints that drove him to madness. Curtin referred to his mental health condition during incarceration as cell madness. Psychosis was a common manifestation of this affliction. A prison doctor reported that Curtin lacerated his skin over a major artery with a knife. He was babbling incoherently. Curtin claimed to have forgotten this incident at a future date. Curtin also expressed a wish to commit suicide. A fellow prisoner commented on his impression and memory of Curtin. Curtin was amiable and sly. He liked to hobnob with the officials. He was also capable of being brutal. He talked a lot about his sexual adventures. He told how once he had bitten a woman's genitals until the blood came. He said, "That's the greatest enjoyment one can get." He then demonstrated how he would behave in doing it. He used to ask all the criminal sexual perverts questions and gave them advice and told them how to conduct themselves on trial. Another inmate spoke about his experience in getting to know Curtin. Curtin thought a lot of his wife, but he also said, "I like veal best, something I can really tease in the dark and quiet places." I asked, "Are you a pervert?" He answered, "Even old goats like to eat a green leaf now and then. A change is nice." Curtin must have thought a lot about his wife after he threatened to stab her between the ribs as a penalty for withholding sex soon after they met. He raped her several times throughout their marriage. He was constantly unfaithful. If she threatened to leave him, he would vow to commit suicide, or he might bemoan the conditions of his overall life with what little he felt she contributed. Despite all this, he spoke admiringly of his wife, having once said, "My relations with my wife were always good. I did not love her in the sensual way, but because of my admiration for her fine character." Generally, though, Curtin was a misogynist. He even alleged that his own sister wanted to have sex with him. This theory was based on her tenderness toward him, with many kisses and other forms of physical affection. Part 9. Motive. Curtin was interviewed by a psychologist. He was asked about his motives. He had this to say: "So far as the motives of my crimes are concerned, as I have so far described them, I took everything I said about my excitability and inner tension from books, names, Lombroso. The statement of motive I made was the result of the trend of the criminal director's questions. He was so preoccupied with the psychological aspects of the case. Even so, I am bound to say that I did have a constant desire. You will call it the urge to kill, and the more the better. Yes, if I had had the means, I would have killed masses. I would have caused catastrophes. Every evening, when my wife was working late, I scoured the town for a victim, but it was not so easy to find one. The sexual urge was strongly developed in me, particularly in the last years, and it was stimulated even more by the crimes themselves. For that reason, I was always driven to find a new victim. Sometimes, even when I seized my victim's throat, I had an orgasm. Sometimes not, but then the orgasm came as I stabbed the victim. It was not my intention to get satisfaction by normal sexual intercourse, but by killing. When the victim struggled, she merely stimulated my lust. For example, I would like to quote the case of Oliger, for which Stausberg was wrongly accused. I didn't have sexual intercourse with the child. It wasn't necessary because I had already ejaculated. The reaction had already set in while I was throttling Oliger, but not ejaculation. It was only while I was stabbing her that the excitement ended in ejaculation. I had my member out and ejaculated without erection, which is much nicer. That happened, too, with Han, and gave me a shudder down the whole back. I want to explain to you also, Professor, about your conclusions as to the sexual parts of the child Oliger. When I was throttling the child, I inserted my middle finger into the vagina. I had pulled down the little knickers a bit, and later on rearranged them. But I did not feel anything. Only when I took the scissors and stabbed, I had an ejaculation. In handling the child, I might have introduced some seminal fluid with my finger, which you found later on. That was the first case. At midnight, I went back to the body. I wanted to touch it. I won't deny that I did it to get fresh sexual excitement, but there was no more ejaculation. Another thing, I only fingered her over her clothing. I could not stay long because my wife was bound to come home." Curtin explains his motive behind the burning. "That, of course, I did not do to destroy the body by fire. I got sexual excitement in doing it, but no ejaculation. The following morning at 9 o'clock, I returned once more, when she had been found. I then saw the officials and the crowd of people, and I nearly had an ejaculation, but not quite." That I wasn't out for normal sexual enjoyment, you can tell from the Shear case. That was a man. I was scouring the Hellweg for a victim. I saw a man coming along. I thought, that's a suitable subject. Not a soul to be seen anywhere. The man was staggering. He bumped into me. He was drunk. I stabbed him with the scissors. At the first stab in the temple, he fell down. Then at once, I got sexual excitement. And the more I stabbed, the more intense it became. I gave him a severe stab in the neck, and I heard distinctly the faint gushing of his blood. That was the climax. Then came the ejaculation. I stopped stabbing and just rolled the body over the bank. The following morning, when I went back, the murder commission was there. Then I enjoyed another ejaculation despite the intense cold. As you know, it was horribly cold at that time, yet I was not conscious of it, though I had on only a very thin coat. When I am in that condition, I am not even conscious of fatigue. During my long night prowlings, when I covered long distances, I was so intent upon my purpose that I never noticed any fatigue at all, and that despite the fact that I had been at work throughout the day. You have asked me when I first detected in myself a tendency to cruelty. Well, that goes back decades. Of course, we went bird nesting and caught frogs, but I was prematurely developed sexually, and at the age of 15 or 16, I was already like that. And then I used to stab sheep, for instance, that were grazing on the Grafenberger meadows. When I did that, I realized that it gave me an agreeable feeling, but without any ejaculation. That was the start of it all, and the first time that I became conscious of the connection between cruelty and the sexual urge. I had also at that time cut the head off of a dog. Then I realized that there was something nice in it. You can imagine that, Professor, and you must try it for yourself sometime, how the blood rushes absolutely silently when you cut off the head of a goose. The origin of this feeling goes back a long way. When we lived in Köln, Mülheim, a dog catcher lived in the same house. At that time, there was one in every town. The dogs were captured, slaughtered, and eaten. The lard was sold as a specific, being used to fix cobwebs over wounds. This dog catcher used to torture the dogs he caught. For instance, he used to prick them with a needle or break off their tails, saying that he wanted to see whether the animals were healthy. I watched this frequently and enjoyed it. I was then 9 years old. This dog catcher also showed me how you make the dogs attached to you, taught me how to play with the dog's genitals until it ejaculated. An animal like that can't be beaten away. Later, when I was 13, I often thought about that dog catcher while I was taking young buzzards and owls from their nests with other boys, or when I caught squirrels or martens. Those we sold to the dealer Otten on the market, I suppose you know it, and we made a nice bit of pocket money in that way. I still have a scar on my finger where a squirrel once fastened his teeth on me. I had to compress his neck to make him let go. In handling it like that, I had an ejaculation, although only a boy of 14. Later, by reading and through talk, I learned about this sort of thing. Seeing blood gave me a pleasant feeling. At that time, the slaughter of pigs in people's homes was more frequent than it is now, and I always liked to watch it. Already, as a schoolboy, I loved to see fires. The shouting and the excitement were fun to me. Whether my youthful onanism had anything to do with it, I don't know. That was not very important. It was only temporary. By the time I was 13, I knew all about sexual matters. And in my own home, I saw my parents have sexual relations. Of course, I soon decided that I would try for myself. I began first with a schoolgirl and got as far as contact with the naked body, but not to proper intercourse, as the girl resisted and moved about too much. In this way, it occurred to me to try it with animals. There were goats in the stables, and a good many sheep used to be kept penned. For this purpose, I went to neighboring stables where it was easy for me to get in. I actually did have intercourse with female animals. I did actually force my member into the animal. Then later, I thought no more of it. It was only a temporary thing about the age of 13. Soon after that, I became aware of the pleasure at the sight of blood. Today it is not clear to me why I went to the stables beyond the Hirschberg. The house is still standing there. I stabbed a pig in the back. It bled terribly and squealed. Then I was seen and recognized because the son of the house and I were schoolfellows. There was a terrible row about it at home. It was in my 13th year that for the first time I secured a complete orgasm by wounding. I attempted sexual intercourse with a sheep. Whether it succeeded or the sheep would not keep still, I forget. I stabbed the sheep and at that moment ejaculated. I repeated that frequently for 2 or 3 years. After that, I only had connection with females. That was at Koblenz. It was after that that I ran away with embezzled money and was accosted on the street by a girl of about 18 years of age. We lived together until the embezzled money was all gone. The sexual intercourse we had then was quite normal. Yet, even then, I pinched the girl, for wounding was not yet the essential condition for success in the intercourse. In Koblenz, at that time, I was not strongly drawn towards the girl. In 3 of 4 weeks, we had relations only a few times. That seems rather strange for a young man. Then came the first imprisonment. Even at that time, I had thoughts about wounding, but they were not insistent. When I came out of prison, I became acquainted by chance with a woman and her daughter of 16. It was the woman who attracted me, but I paid no attentions to the daughter. That seems rather strange. The intercourse with the woman succeeded only when I ill-treated her. In the beginning, she put up with it. But when it became worse and I threatened to kill her, she gave me away to the police, and I was punished for using threats and failing to keep the domestic peace. I got 1 week. During my first long sentence for theft, 1 of 8 months, I was separated from this woman. Then I met her again in 1904 and started up with the daughter. I ill-treated her and threatened her with a revolver. It was an out-of-date old thing that would not have been capable of hurting her. I had great fun as they ran away and I sent shots after them. While I was doing that, I ejaculated. Another shooting occurred at that time. While I was in prison, I had figured out how I would shoot a girl I knew in Grothenburg. At that mere thought, I felt sexual excitement. I had known this girl at school. I studied the place where she lived and actually waited for days in order to kill her. One morning, I watched her from the courtyard how she got out of bed and then a shot at her. After a while, when things quietened and down again, I fired again that evening through the window. Then I fled to the Grafenberger Wald, was chased and arrested and found with the weapon. I confessed and got a year's imprisonment. Curtin commented on the throttling cases. I told you already that throttling in itself was a pleasure to me, even without any intention to kill. Take, for example, the Schaefer case in 1913. I had taken his girl out frequently, and at last we spent the whole night in the Grafenberger Wald. I then throttled her several times, and she did not mind. I just calmed her down. "This is all part of love," I said. "I don't want to kill you." It was only the beginning, when I inserted my member in her vagina on the bench. It was in the wood that I had an ejaculation, and then without sexual connection at all. It was just the same in the case of Franken in 1913. There, too, I throttled the girl for some time and saw how the blood spurted from her mouth, and in that way got my ejaculation. In other cases, I did not achieve my end by throttling. For instance, Moss, I throttled her violently too, but she freed herself and ran away. Curtin was asked if he throttled any of the victims to the point of death. He said he believed he had done so with the Oliger child because she was inanimate after the throttling. He said he believed Annie was dead after the throttling, which is why he threw her body into the Rhine. Curtin went into detail about the effects incarceration had on him. The long sentences I served, when still quite young, had a very bad effect on me. Other prisoners think of naked women and masturbate. This I did very seldom. I got no pleasure from it. I got my climax of enjoyment when I imagined something horrible in my cell in the evenings. For instance, slitting up somebody's stomach, and how the public would be horrified. The thought of wounding was my peculiar lust, and it was in that way that I got my ejaculations. I can remember exactly how it happened in 1905 in the prison at Metz. There, for the first time, I got an ejaculation by thinking of grievous woundings and the actual killing of people. That went on for years. If I hadn't had that, I would have hanged myself. There is really nothing astonishing about the fact that, having got out of prison, well used to such imaginings, I was urged to do the things. You remind me, Professor, of the Molheim crime. It is certain that just then I had 7 years in Munster behind me. Actually, I had gone out to steal, and the murder was incidental. But you are quite wrong, Professor, if you think that this crime stands as a single case in those years. No, one thing and then another happened, but there were no big jobs. But when the decisions came, it came suddenly because of the opportunity, in contrast to the last years when the urge has dominated me continuously. The child Klein lay in her bed asleep. I seized her throat, and at once my sexual excitement began. During the throttling, I grasped the child's vagina with my fingers in order to tear it open, but it was not enough for my lust. I cut the throat. It is the blood that is decisive in most of the cases. Throttling alone is insufficient to produce ejaculation. There is, for instance, the case of the Italian. I only knew her Christian name, Marianne. She could satisfy herself by sucking, but I got no pleasure out of that, so I throttled her for about 10 minutes, but without success, for she did not scream, but defended herself vigorously. Then, again, the case of Anna Ist, I treated her so badly that she was black and blue. Yet, even after that, she went out with me again. Some women are funny. I can't say, Professor, that there were periods when my urge was stronger or weaker. Only during the period of hunger in Brig Prison, I became a walking corpse and had no desire for sex. That is why nothing had happened at Altenburg. I only ill-treated women in order to get an ejaculation, but without complete sexual intercourse. It was only when I came to Dusseldorf and began to have relations with Taida that I indulged more frequently in cruelty. In the beginning, Taida put up with it. Then, when she learned that I was married, she charged me with it. Besides her, I had Meck and Kiefer in the Parkstrasse at the same time. When there seemed to be long gaps in the list of my crimes, I confess it is due to the terms of imprisonment, or to the fact that I failed in some projected assault. There are smaller attempts in between which I do not remember clearly myself, and therefore have either not confessed or divulged. It was during this period that I committed arson on many occasions. I did not reveal all of the arsons during the investigation by the police. I then gave another reason for these crimes, but that was because it was more or less suggested to me, and out of egotism, I did not contradict them. It is not true that I wanted to kill the vagabonds sleeping in the haystacks I fired. It is a fact that I had no such thought. In my imagination, arson played the same role as other mass accidents. When the people dashed about screaming, I enjoyed it immensely. The bright glow of the fire at night was exciting. But one thing is certain, the frequency of the cases in these last years was due to the injustice of the sentences I served. When in 1926 I was sent to the remand prison, I was absolutely mad. I had the feeling that I was innocent. To that feeling were added imaginings of a sexual kind. Therefore, after my release in 1927, many more arsons took place than are mentioned on the list here. Besides, in addition to the case of Ist, there were minor cases of attempted throttling. In 1927, I was sentenced again for false pretenses, which weren't false pretenses at all. Taida had sworn falsely. In 1928, I again suffered an unjust prison sentence for alleged threats and insults. I was absolutely innocent. I resent that even to this day. You will now realize, Professor, why there were frequent arsons from 1927 onwards. I must answer your question whether I was suspected by anyone with a no. I revealed everything after my arrest and without being asked. I don't want to pretend to you, Professor, that a desire to boast had not something to do with that confession. It was a bit of Curtin Sr. coming out in me. You must try to put yourself in my place. The highest police officers were hemming me in. They all marveled at me as a miracle. That was why I took on more than was really true. For instance, the murders in Altenburg, the details of which are fresh in my memory from gossip. They often marveled at my memory. Things that happened 20 or 30 years ago, I can describe to you with every detail. I can recall the day and the hour of every arson I committed. But the statements which I made previously about wanting to kill the down-and-outs sleeping in the haystacks by firing them are true only insofar as I had no original intention of killing people in that way. During the firing itself, the thought that human beings might be burnt added to the sensations that I experienced. I always watched the fires, usually from near at hand, so near in that I have been asked to give a helping hand. Otherwise, I was among the spectators of the street. The shouting of the people and the glare of the fire pleased me. During big fires, I always came to an ejaculation. If you see in the list sometimes several arsons in one evening, then I had had no success with the first or the second. I also ejaculated when I fired the woods. It was a lovely sight when one pine after another was consumed in the flames, fanned by the sharp east wind. That was wonderful. At the arson in the Wolfsop, I had no success in the beginning, so I left it and made my way to the Stutzhof farm and set a barn alight. But as the barn was some distance and isolated, there were few people about, for the people were all at Wolfsop. So I went back again to the barn. Meanwhile, some excitement had started up. Fire engines came up, rumbling. The tiles of the roof cracked with the heat, and the reports of them bursting resounded to the borders of the woods. The owls then hooted, and I ejaculated. Again, when I fired the peat belonging to the Heimaiten, there was not enough noise. A policeman had to come around and arouse the people, and even then they didn't get up. That is why that same evening I set fire to the Hohenzollern colony. That was another matter altogether. The whole colony crowded together, and I ejaculated. I tried to set fire to the Dusseldorf orphanage several times, but the fire always petered out again. I probably ought not to have done it because of the orphans. The three arsons of January 1929 that took place on the same evening also came about because it was too quiet at the first fire at the Papendal haystack. The second fire at the barn in the field did not catch, and only at the third fire, when the stack was blazing and there was a great commotion, did I have success. Curtin delves further into the subject of his sexual acts. You ask me how it is possible for me to have normal sexual intercourse at all. Well, if I don't ill-treat the woman during the intercourse, then I get no orgasm. Even with my wife, I had to use a sort of fantasy. Otherwise, I was impotent. It was usually my wife who took the initiative for intercourse. After we had been married 6 months, she used to say, "Are we married or aren't we?" She has always had to help me get an erection, and even then, in order to succeed, I had to conjure up all kinds of fantasies, and then it took a long time. So, too, with my victims. I never succeeded without brutalities, not even with Hahn. She believed that I had had complete intercourse with her, but I did not ejaculate. Without violence, my member slackens quickly in the vagina. It was so with Butley's and the others with whom I was supposed to have had complete connection. I have told you already that the main thing with me was to see blood. Here I must tell you of another recent case. Whenever I happened to be near a serious accident in the street, I felt sexually excited. A short time before I was arrested, I saw a brakesman fall from the freight wagon of a streetcar on Erkrotherstrasse and go under its wheels. The blood gushed out and I pretended to assist the victim. I then had an orgasm. Such cases happen frequently, even with animals. Thus, once on the corner of the Mintropstrasse, I saw a horse that had been knocked over by a tram. The animal bled to death. By chance, I saw it all and ejaculated. Whether I took a knife or a pair of scissors or a hammer in order to see blood was a matter of indifference to me or mere chance. Often after the hammer blows, the bleeding victims moved and struggled, just as they did when they were throttled. I never got an orgasm at the start of these proceedings, and for that reason, I had to continue them. For instance, the Alberman case. I felt nothing while actually throttling. That was why I repeated what I did in the Mulheim case, putting my fingers in the child's vagina. On that, erection took place at once, and I then introduced my member into the vagina of the child. That was only an attempt, for my member relaxed again, and I had to stab. Then only ejaculation took place. I can hear the bleeding, even when the stabbing is through the clothing, into the heart. It was thus as I lay on the Alberman child, my member still in the child's vagina, while I continued to stab her breast. It was similar, too, with Han. There, too, I had no satisfaction during the sexual act. Only later on, during the throttling, I became stiff again, and when, as I stabbed her throat, the blood gushed from the wound, I drank the blood from the wound and ejaculated. I probably drank too much blood because I vomited. The Han girl was still alive, despite the terrible loss of blood. Finally, to kill her, I stabbed her in the breast, and again I heard the gushing of blood. My return twice to this girl's body was for purpose of security. The body could not be left in the stream. As I carried the body to the grave, which I had dug, I thought about crucifying her. I had taken strong staples with me and wanted to nail the body to a tree with outspread arms. But I had not time. That, of course, was warranted to stir up some excitement. I then stood in her grave and drew the body down to me. In fingering it and holding it firmly, the upper part was naked, I became once more sexually excited and had an orgasm. It struck me that the body was not stiff, but quite flaccid. She hung limp over my shoulder when I carried her. I must now answer your question whether simple stabbing was sufficient to satisfy my sexual desire, and I must answer yes. For example, when I was going after Anna Goldhausen, I got sexual excitement on turning the corner and going towards her as she came towards me. I had an erection as I stabbed her, but no orgasm. Therefore, I went on stabbing. I had no satisfaction when I stabbed Frau Mantell, because the woman shouted so terribly that I had to run away as fast as I could. Only in the third case of stabbing did I have an orgasm, that of Kornblum, but without complete erection. Afterwards, my wife discovered the spots on my clothes in the same way as she discovered in the case of Han, and reproached me with it. Also with Frau Kuhn, I had an orgasm, and despite the fact that it was bitterly cold, and that the whole attack took but seconds, with the flea of children, the throttling and struggling of the little hummocker, had an exciting effect, and the sound of the blood when I cut her throat made me ejaculate. With the older child, Lenzen, it was the resistance that excited me, and finally the stabbing which brought the climax, but without erection. That evening, I was already in a state of strong sexual excitement. Again, the day after the crime, when I visited Flya and saw the tremendous excitement of the people, I ejaculated. The Schult case on the following day did not differ from the others. My sexual lust was appeased because of what had happened the day before, and it was only in the dark, during the shouting, cutting, and stabbing, that I had an orgasm. In the case of Reuter, too, I ejaculated. The girl had collapsed after the first hammer blow, and then when I had dragged her away from the path, she regained consciousness and bit and struggled. It was through that I became excited, even without the shedding of blood. Even so, I had to continue striking with the hammer, for I had not ejaculated when I had connection with her. It was much the same with Dorier when she was lying unconscious after the first hammer blow. I had already exposed myself, had an erection, and had already penetrated her. But even then, I had to keep on striking with the hammer until I ejaculated. I also gripped her neck with my left hand. In Wander's case, the excitement had no climax because the hammer broke. Her head was harder than the hammer. I have already told you, Professor, of the Han case and how I drank the blood from the wound of her neck. As I told you, I stabbed her throat and, lying across her, I drank the blood that gushed out. While I did that, I thrust my scissors with my right hand several times into her breast. In the case of Oliger, I also sucked blood from the wound on her temple, and from sheer from the stab in the neck. From the girl Schult, I only licked the blood from her hands. It was the same with the swan in the Hofgarten. I used to stroll at night through the Hofgarten very often. And in the spring of 1930, I noticed a swan sleeping at the edge of the lake. I cut its throat. The blood spurted up, and I drank from the stump and ejaculated. Your question too, Professor, whether the recollection of my deeds makes me feel ashamed. I will tell you. Thinking back to all the details is not at all unpleasant. I rather enjoy it. To be sure, I pity the victims, but in conjuring up the memories of my imagination, I even succeed in getting sexual satisfaction. These explanations, Professor, are only intended for you as a scientist, for I have told you with complete frankness my innermost feelings. Such things are not good for the public. They can only do harm and certainly no good. It was on this account that at my trial I put forward other explanations for my crimes. That may at least do some good towards the reform of the penal system. So far as my own fate is concerned, I am tranquil. It is because of that I am able thus quietly to answer your question whether I am not sorry for my confession with no. It is because of that I am able thus quietly to answer your question whether or not I am sorry for my confession with no. It is better that I made an end of it. I would not have stopped my attacks. I was impelled over and over again. But I also want to point out that I was able to master my urge. Therein lies my guilt, that I did not do it in the murder cases. I know quite well that there I am guilty. Therefore, I want to shoulder my punishment. After having spent 24 years in such institutions, I prefer death to pardon. Though prison is different today from what it was in earlier times, I see the contempt on the faces of the prison officials and the other prisoners. Those men, Professor, don't understand, as usual. But after all, people are right when they say, "The beast, the wild animal." Peter Curtin received the death penalty for his crimes. He was decapitated by a guillotine. As he walked to the location of his execution, he was accompanied on either side by the prison's psychiatrist and a priest. before putting his head into position, there was one question on Curtin's mind, and he posed it to the psychiatrist. "Tell me, after my head is chopped off, will I still be able to hear, at least for a moment, the sound of my own blood gushing from the stump of my neck? That would be the pleasure to end all pleasures." When asked if he had any last words, he simply said, "No." Following the execution, Curtin's head was bisected and mummified. Forensic investigators examined it to discover physical anomalies that may have explained how he became a human monster. His head is currently on display at the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum in Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin. Thank you for listening to Human Monsters. Bye for now.